Counsel, you ready to proceed on the Davis matter? All right, then we'll call case number 87371, State v. Davis. Mr. Chen?
Thank you, and if I could reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Good morning, Alexander Chen on behalf of the appellant in this particular matter. So in this particular case, the district court dismissed two counts via a pretrial petition for writ of habeas corpus regarding two kidnapping counts of the three victims that the state had charged in its information. The longstanding rule of this court is that whether the movement of the victim is incidental to the associated offense and whether the risk of harm is substantially increased thereby are questions of fact to be determined by the trier of fact in all but the clearest of cases. And I would submit this is not the clearest of case in which the district court should have dismissed these two kidnapping counts. The facts surrounding this particular case involve three individuals. Actually, there was four individuals inside of a Olive Garden, but three of them were listed as victims. And an individual, the defendant, first started the incident of the robbery in the parking lot with regards to Paredes Moreno. Now, that is the one count that did remain for the district court. But the other two individuals were dismissed as kidnapping victims. One of them was Gilberto Limon. That particular individual was working at the Olive Garden as well, and he was the one who mistakenly opened the door for the defendant because he thought that Moreno, who was outside already, was coming back in because he had forgotten his keys. So basically, Limon couldn't see that there was a gun pointed towards his colleague. That's what the state of the evidence was at the preliminary hearing. Upon the Limon opening the door, then the defendant...
So Mr. Chen, yes. just to clarify, the business is closed.
The business
at
is closed.
This point. So yes. When he opens the door, the business is closed.
Yes.
Okay.
That is correct. And at that point, upon opening the door for the business that is closed, as Justice Siglich pointed out, he's taken through the restaurant. Both individuals are taken through the restaurant, which means they're going from the front of the restaurant all the way through the kitchen, all the way to the back office. Now, there's a question of fact that should be determined by a jury in terms of where the manager was, Mr. Partridge was at that time. Because what ends up happening is everyone goes to this back office area. It appears from the testimony that Mr. Partridge, in fact, was in the office and then was surprised when he heard that someone was inside the establishment with a gun, and he leaves the office. But upon the defendant coming to the area, he brings all three of them into the office where the safe is, and he tries to open the safe, and other things happen. But the reason that this is such an important question of fact is because there's unestablished evidence in terms of what else was going on and where these individuals were placed. For the sake of the petition for writ of habeas corpus, all the court had to determine was whether there was probable cause. It didn't need to determine as a matter of law whether these charges could both stand. But instead, the court ruled as a matter of law that it was insufficient, that there was not probable cause to even go to a jury to determine what had happened in the situation. And I think the longstanding law of this court is that these do need to be resolved by a jury. When you look at cases like Gonzalez, when you look at cases like Medbury and Mendoza, they basically explain that, in Langford, sorry, that this is absolutely a question of fact that needs to be meted out. And in fact, Sheriff V. Medbury is the one that said they reversed a pretrial petition for writ of habeas corpus, much like this case. And in that particular case, they even said it needed to go to a jury to determine whether the movement would have caused increased harm because there were bullets flying in a jail hostage situation. And so that was a question that needed to be determined as a matter of fact by the jury. Now, when applying, ultimately, the court did look at the Mendoza factors and determined as a matter of law that we had not met our probable cause in this particular case, but I think that was error, and that's why we are asking this court to reverse the district court. And the reason that I say that is, even if you look at the Mendoza factors and we're trying to determine probable cause, it lists five factors, And those are all or questions. So, for instance, any movement was not incidental to the robbery. In this particular case, there's evidence that the movement was not incidental to the robbery. There was movement throughout the establishment, but then even when they get to the office area, the defendant orders everyone to empty their pockets. He holds them longer than is necessary to commit a robbery. And that wasn't part of the robbery. It wasn't part of anything that the defendant took. He, in fact, wanted the IDs so he could hold them, say that he knew where they lived, say that he knew that they shouldn't try to do anything stupid. So that was extra restraint. That was extra movement. There was extra parts of the kidnapping that the jury should be able to determine whether the state has actually proven it beyond a reasonable doubt. So that was the first part with regard, one of the first Mendoza factors. The second one, so any incidental movement substantially increased risk of harm to the victim over and above what's necessary to complete the robbery. We would again submit this should have gone to the jury because there was movement from the front all the way to the back area, and there's a possibility that a lot of things worse could have happened in an area where there weren't people. And even when the police come, it's a scary situation because the testimony was that the manager calls the police, and they don't know who's still in the facility because they're in the back office area. So the police the 911 operator is on the call with Mr. Partridge, and at the entire time, they're saying, do you feel safe to come out? Do you feel that you can enter the front to go meet the police at the front of the restaurant? Don't leave if you don't think that you're safe. So ultimately, there's a lot of facts here to support that this should have gone to a jury because it was a situation in which being in the back was an area where the risk was substantially increased.
Mr. Chin, just a quick question on
yes.
that. If the, you know, sometimes we encounter these situations where there's a register in the front.
Yes.
And they steal from the register, and then they move people to a back office.
Yes.
Is it a distinction with a difference or without a difference, the fact that the register, the safe, is in the back office? So that's where they're going to get the money.
Sure.
So is the fact that that's where everybody's headed, is that a distinction with a difference from, do you understand my question?
I do, and I think it does matter because if the object is to rob someone, so basically unlawful taking of property by threat of use of force, the individual has an opportunity to do that at the register right in the front, has the opportunity to order them to give over their wallets, take whatever's on their person. The fact, though, that a safe happens to be in a different area, it is important because just by, I don't know if it's luck of the draw, but there is a distinction that you're going to move to a different area. If you keep extrapolating your scenario, what if the safe was at the individual's house? So now we're all getting into a car and we're moving to a different area and we're still trying to rob them of the money that belongs to Olive Garden, but at the same time, where does it end? And that's why it's such an important question of fact for the jury to determine it, not a matter of law. So in this particular case, I do absolutely think it matters that the safe happened to be in the back where it was secluded. There was no easy entry to the back there. And so I do think it matters significantly.
So, Mr. Chen, would you agree that our review is de novo as to the district court's decision on the habeas petition?
I do. De novo as to whether probable cause actually was determined or should have been determined in this particular case.
So there's no deference owed in this situation to the district court's determination?
I don't believe so. Correct. And I know that there was some slight error in terms of putting some post-conviction language in our brief, but I would say mm-hmm. that in this particular case, the only question is about probable cause and whether legally the court should have or was erred in denying the fact that probable cause had been shown in this case.
And are you arguing anything unique to Gilbert, who was the gentleman, I call him Gilbert, who opened the front door when he thought his colleague needed to get back in? His situation seems to me that, like, the increased risk of harm is an easier argument because he was moved from the front of the restaurant where he could have had easy exit to the back and corralled with others in the room where the safe was. Are you making that argument or not?
Well, I would say that I agree that when it comes time for a jury trial, those two may be differently situated, and by that I mean Gilbert versus Partridge. But I think that as a matter of probable cause, they all should be linked in together at this particular point in time. I do think that there are some additional factors with regards to Lamone in which we could argue that he was moved, obviously, a greater distance. I don't know that he was quite inveigled in terms of opening the door and being tricked to open the door for this individual. But again, that's why I think it's just important that these are factual matters that should go to a jury.
So your point is that regardless, both of the Dan and Gilbert are in the same boat for purposes of right now. It might be different at trial factually, but for probable cause and it's low bar.
Exactly.
You would say both go past habeas.
That would be our argument for today. And certainly, as Justice Stiglitz's example pointed out, had we been talking about a robbery in which, let's say, the cashier was behind the bar and turns around, gets the cash out, gives it to the individual who's robbing the place, perhaps in that particular scenario, that would be incredibly incidental, and that might be the type of case that Mendoza was contemplating. But at least here, I think there's enough factors that there was additional movement and that we had proven it. And I just want to point out one other thing with regards to the law that's being applied here, is when you're talking about Mendoza and the factors there, the question that they answered there was whether a conviction could lie or be sustained for both the robbery and the kidnapping. So that's upon being convicted, because we don't want individuals being convicted for the same conduct where the legislature didn't intend for it. Certainly, if a jury were to find the individual here guilty, there would be remedies, whether through appeal or even the district court, if hearing the evidence heard that there just wasn't enough to sustain that, the district court could take action. But it certainly wasn't appropriate for the district court to take this action in a pretrial habeas petition. I similarly would, just for the sake of argument, say, what if the state, in charging this particular case, had only charged the kidnapping and using the robbery as a predicate? Well, in that particular case, there wouldn't be a robbery case for them to be duly convicted of, but yet under this, what the district court did here is that as a matter of law said, this just can't happen, and you can't have a robbery and kidnapping. And again, if there was no robbery case, I just feel that it would be error as a matter of law to make that decision, especially if we didn't charge a robbery. So with that, I'll submit it for right now, and I appreciate the court's time. Thank you.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chen. Mr. Gregory?
All right. Good morning, Your Honors. Julian Gregory on behalf of Respondent Torres Davis in this case. May it please the court. Your Honors, this is a case about the district court's statutory power to review probable cause determinations through the mechanism of a pretrial writ of habeas corpus. That authority is granted by NRS 34.700, and this court has held in Sheriff v. Provenza that absent a showing of substantial error, this court will not overturn the granting of a pretrial habeas petition for lack of probable cause. I would submit that the state has not provided any authority, any on-point authority, that this is a de novo standard of review. Sheriff E. Witzenberg, which is what they cited to, had to do with whether or not Crawford and a confrontation right attached at a preliminary hearing. It was not a probable cause determination. It's a different standard. The State v. Hubler case, as the state conceded, was a post-conviction habeas petition, a different animal. Under this court's jurisprudence, the standard of review is substantial error. And I would submit that the district court in this case did not substantially err. Now, the state's argument that this is a question for the jury ignores the fact that the district court is empowered to dismiss charges lacking in probable cause. The Curtis D. decision had to do with whether a dual conviction could survive appellate review. This court held that It was a question of fact to be determined by the trier of fact in all but the clearest cases. This is such a clear case. Otherwise, to hold differently in this case would engender an absurd result, which would be that this court could review probable cause determinations for any charge except for kidnapping as a related charge of robbery. The Mendoza factors that the state went into, the first is whether or not the movement stands alone with independent significance. It's not an issue here. It wasn't raised in the state's brief. Unless the court has questions about that, I'm going to move on from that factor. Second factor is whether the movement created a risk substantially in excess of that necessarily present in a robbery. I would submit that that is not the case here. In a robbery, you're going to have somebody coming up to you, pointing a gun at you, saying, give me your wallet, give me your property, and that's what happened here.
Counsel, isn't taking someone during a robbery from an otherwise public space to a place of seclusion, like the paradigmatic kind of example given, that means they've been put in more danger? That makes, I mean, you know, the seclusion piece of it.
Yes, Your Honor. In every case that the state has cited to support their case, with the exception of Medbury, Gonzalez, Stewart, and Garina, there was this aspiration element, a movement from a public place into a private one. What we have here is a movement from a private place into a private place.
Do you draw a distinction in the fact that it's the front of a restaurant? So just somebody driving by could see if people are working or whatnot, but if they're brought back to the office, then they're taken from potential view or from potential rescue?
I would say that the fact that the restaurant was closed at the time, that it was very late in the evening, it was about 12:45 by my recollection, transmutes this from a public place into a private one. And therefore, the movement of the perpetrator from the victims from the front room of the from the front lobby of the restaurant into the back office, it's exactly on par with Wright v. State. In Wright v. State, there was movement from the hotel lobby into a hotel back office. There was movement back into the lobby. There was restraint. The victims were actually tied up and left there. And in Wright v. State, this court held dual convictions could not lie.
But we're not at the dual conviction stage. We're at the probable cause stage.
Right, Your Honor. And it's my position that the probable cause is not there under Nevada law.
But the standards are different. I mean, this is a pretrial habeas, and Wright was either direct appeal or post-conviction. And so the two standards are different.
Yes, Your Honor, they are. But the standard in this case is substantial error.
Well, substantial error, if you make an error of law, is substantial error on its face. I mean, to me, then that's a de novo review standard, right?
No, Your Honor, I would disagree.
I think you may be overreading Provenza.
I respectfully disagree with that, with the court's assessment.
Okay.
There.
Fair enough.
But I would say that the standard is substantial error. It's not a de novo standard of review.
Do you think there is some evidence presented that the movement was not incidental?
No, Your Honor, I do not. The evidence, again, clearly follows Wright, and if the evidence that we have here is movement within a private area. It's exactly on point with Wright. And if this case were not to go my way at this stage, if we were to bring this up on direct appeal. I do not believe that the convictions would lie, just based, again, as a matter of law. So with that, Your Honors, I know I've got a significant amount of time remaining, but I think I've run out of things to talk about. So with that said, unless there are any further questions, I will conclude.
Let me inquire. Colleagues, do you have any further questions for Mr. Gregory?
No, thank you. I'm good.
I would ask, and if you're not familiar with the case, that's fair, but further to the Provenza point, what do you make of Sheriff versus Stewart, which is a 1993 decision that as I read it, holds that if the state meets its burden to show probable cause that the defendant committed the crime, then it's substantial error for the district court to grant the pretrial habeas. And that it's not a factual determination in this case. It is whether or not construing these facts, it's a question of fact. There was enough to make it a question of fact for the jury to decide, so that it should have gone past the probable cause stage, past the pretrial habeas stage, and on to trial for the jury to determine those facts.
Your Honor, I'm not familiar with the Sheriff v. Stewart state. If the court's so inclined, I would be happy to submit additional briefing on that issue.
No need. It's a hard line in this case because you're essentially arguing for deferential review to the district court judge, yet it was not the district court judge that heard the evidence. It was the justice court judge or the grand jury. And so the district court judge in this case is making a legal determination with respect to probable cause, not a factual one. So in this arena, it seems like our review would be de novo, not deferential.
I understand the court's position on that, Your Honor's position on that. What I would submit is that the plain language of the cases indicates there is some deference to be paid to the district court. And unless there are further questions, I will conclude by stating, Your Honors, this is a straightforward case about the district court's power to review probable cause. There was no substantial error. This is one of the clearest cases that could be brought before this court, and is that contemplated by Curtis D. and by Mendoza. And with that, I would submit it.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Gregory.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Chen?
I would actually respect
you. You all are hurting my feelings. Nobody wants to. You're leaving a lot of time on the table, but that's all right, gentlemen. That's your prerogative. So then this matter will stand submitted. Thank you for your arguments, and the court will stand in recess.